If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. This month sees the 75th anniversary of the British and American attack on Dresden in 1945. The bombing raid devastated the German city, and it remains one of the most controversial actions by the Allies during the Second World War. The Dresden raid is the subject of a new book by the historical author Sinclair Mackay, and he met up with our editor Rob Attar in London to discuss the story of a wartime tragedy. Rob began by asking Sinclair to describe the city's history prior to the Nazi era.
Well, I mean, the thing about Dresden was that before the darkness of Nazism stole over, it was this extraordinary kind of flashing cultural jewel. A very beautiful city nestled deep in the valley of the Elbe River, only 100 miles or so from Prague. So very close to the Czech border, very close to the Polish border, and surrounded by some gentle hills and forests and some rocky plains. And it was fantastic. Draw for huge numbers of artists and musicians. Wagner lived there in the 19th century. In the 20th century, Richard Strauss was there at the opera company. Amid the many brilliant artists they had over the years, Caspar David Friedrich, the romantic artist of the 19th century, lived in Dresden for many years. And you can see actually how the city kind of influenced and informed some of his work. Then you get the famous modernists like Otto Dix. These modernists who were there at the Dresden Academy of Arts, which itself was kind of pulsatingly of vigorous. And on top of that, it drew visitors from right the way around the world, but particularly huge numbers of English and American visitors and people who came to live there from England and America. There was actually an English language newspaper in Dresden before the First World War. There was an American church. There was English restaurants. Debutantes from England went out there to learn German, but also to go to finishing school. So here you had an incredibly cosmopolitan city that was called the Florence of the Elbe, but it was even more cosmopolitan than Florence. It was part of a 19th and 20th century grand tour. You had to go to Dresden and had this fantastic social world that would have went with it.
So then in 1933, when the Nazis take over in Germany, to what extent does Dresden change as a result of Nazi rule?
It changes almost instantly simply because the pressure of Nazism from the start was so intense. The most obvious example of that being Hitler's hatred of modernist art. He said that such art was the product of sick brains. And so a few years before the famous degenerate art exhibition of modernist paintings that the Nazis staged, Dresden was among the first cities to kind of fall victim to this. Artists like Otto Griebel and Konrad Felix Müller and Otto Dix were proscribed instantly in 1933 by the Gauleiter, Martin Mutschmann, who also banned jazz almost instantaneously. Anything modernist would not be tolerated. Now, that's from the city's artistic point of view. That was the most obvious change. Obviously, from the point of view of the city's many, I think there were some 7,000 Jewish people in Dresden. It was a fantastic place in terms of just that, but this kind of carefully, because it was more than assimilation with the Jewish population. It was not any kind of issue at all. There was a fantastic 19th century synagogue built by the same architect who had built the opera house, and it stood there so proudly on the banks of the river in the very centre of the city, not far away from the sort of cathedral and all the rest of it. And so Dresden's Jewish population was tremendously kind of relaxed and very, very happy in the city. 1933, obviously, that instantly changes. And there were a lot of very anxious conversations from the start about leaving and how best to go. There were Jewish owners of department stores in Dresden, some of the wonderfully kind of grand department stores, which had some jewelry and furs and all the rest. But these department stores were appropriated instantly by the Nazis. Jewish businesses generally were appropriated by the Nazis. Then by 1938, of course, you had Kristallnacht. And in Dresden, that was a night of horror, as it was across Germany. But in Dresden, particularly hurtful to Jews, because Kristallnacht started in on that beautiful synagogue, which went up in flames against the November sky. In terms of other changes, Dresden wasn't just this amazing cultural jewel. It was also an incredible place for inventors and inventions and new and coming technology. And that's the other kind of thing that changed. Before the Nazis and basically the turn of the 20th century, this was a city that had seen the most fantastic kind of leaps of invention. Obviously, in the 18th century, they had porcelain. Porcelain is the great sort of Dresden innovation that swept the world, and decorative porcelain, which is what Dresden became famous for throughout Europe. But there were also sort of the other inventions, like mouthwash, that came from Dresden. Karl Lingner invented mouthwash there. There was a huge emphasis on kind of the public hygiene. There was firms like Seidel and Naumann that made brilliant typewriters and bicycles and sewing machines, which again were sort of exported right the way across Europe, right the way across the continent. There was Zeiss Icon, the fantastic photography firm, which brought in huge kind of innovations in terms of kind of home photography and home cinema photography too. Now, with the advent of the Nazis, once again, all that very gradually started to change. And as the war approached, and then as war came, all these brilliant factories, which were doing all this brilliant kind of technical work with optics and new technology, were turned entirely to the purposes of war. And those who worked in those factories saw gradually the importation of forced labor, slave labor, basically. The women drawn from the USSR, Jewish women drawn from concentration camps, working in incredibly kind of hideously stressed conditions. So again, the atmosphere of the city changed kind of instantly with 1933. But for the Dresdeners themselves, these citizens having to kind of adapt to this new world where suddenly blood-red swastikas were flying on civic buildings, and yet still these beautiful operas were being performed and the extraordinary ethereal choirs were still singing. How was it possible for the two to kind of to coexist? And that, I think, is one of the central kind of fascinations of the pre-bombing story of Dresden.
And how enthusiastic were the people of Dresden for Nazism, and how far did they go along with things like the anti-Semitic persecution and the acceptance of forced labourers?
Now, I think it's incredibly difficult to gauge enthusiasm, because this was they were living in a terrorist state, basically. All citizens were living under the threat of death. Telephones were being bugged, conversations were being monitored. If you didn't give the Hitler salute in the street, you could be beaten up by SS thugs. Anyone could be taken in the middle of the night, taken to cells, beaten up, executed for simply loose talk or demoralizing talk. So I think it's fair to say not much in the way of enthusiasm. And the counterpoint to that, actually, now one of the things I found so piercingly touching in the Dresden story is that we have the diaries of Professor Victor Klemperer, a philology professor and Jewish philology professor. It was forbidden for Jewish people to keep diaries, again, on pain of death. If the diaries had been discovered, that basically would have been it. But with great courage, he kept this day-to-day diary from 1933 right the way through to his death in 1959, which gives the most extraordinary kind of overview from the Jewish point of view of what was happening in the city. He and his wife decided to stay, even though he was expelled from the university. He was no longer even allowed to use the university library. He was forced to have his cat put down because the Nazis said that Jews were not permitted to keep pets. The cruelties piled up day by day by day and became ever more excruciating. And he could see how Dresden's Jewish population was being basically taken to death camps week by week, day by day. More and more and more Jewish people were getting the orders to pack a bag for 3 days and go to the railway station. Professor Victor Klemperer made clear they knew what was happening. It wasn't a secret. That was what made it so particularly terrifying. But there's a counterpoint to that, which was that he also noted moments of extraordinary kindness from Gentile Dresdeners who would quietly, either in a shop, slip him extra rations that he wasn't allowed to have, or would perform others of small acts. He was in a forced labor party in the mid-1940s during the war, sweeping snow from the roads. And the supervisor could see he was an old man with an ailing heart. And he said, look, actually, just don't push yourself too hard. Just stand on the side there. Those small acts of kindness, he noted, and they now make an extraordinarily moving reading, because you do wonder, among a population of German civilians, so many of them could see, so many of them said to Professor Klemperer, we hate what they're doing to the Jews. So you do wonder very much, really.
And prior to the raid in February 45, how far had the war militarily affected Dresden, and particularly in terms of bombing?
In relation to other German cities, which, of course, Dresden had heard all the news about, so, you know, the devastation in Hamburg, Cologne, Lübeck, Mannheim, all these German cities which had been hit, the Dresdeners were slightly ignored the fact that they hadn't been hit. There were some rumours going around that Churchill's grandmother had lived in Dresden for a while, and that was why Dresden was ignored by the Allied bombers. They didn't want to touch this place, which had a special place in Churchill's heart. It had been targeted before. It had been targeted in 1944 by the Americans in daytime raids. And the Americans were going specifically for the railway marshalling yards, because Dresden was a huge transport hub. It was a hugely busy railway junction with lines going out to Eastern Europe, to Southern Europe, up to Berlin, and there was a huge amount of military movement through the city. And so the Americans made these daytime raids in 1944, which claimed several hundred lives, and sent the people of Dresden down to these makeshift, extemporized shelters. But the people of Dresden were always watchful. They were always expecting it. But there were no special shelters built for them. Unlike other German cities, it was felt by the Dresden authorities that it was not necessary to construct special bomb-proof shelters. Underneath the city, underneath the old city, was just a whole maze of brick cellars which had been sort of knocked through. These low little brick cellars through which people could move basically under the old city from the River Elbe to the Great Garden Park. These were deemed sufficient. There was only one special shelter, specially constructed shelter in the city, and that was for the Gauleiter, Martin Mutschmann. He was all right. Everyone else was the fire alarms would go off night by night. They would always be false alarms, these air raid sirens. People would troop wearily down to these low brick cellars, furnished very sparsely with little brick tables. They would kind of sit there. And that was their experience of the bombing war before February 1945. A whole series of air raid alarms which always disturbed their sleep, but never brought any bombers with them. So when the night of February the 13th, 1945 came, no one could have anticipated.
And so why, from the Allied side, was Dresden chosen, not only to be bombed, but to be bombed in such numbers and such ferocity?
It was, despite what a number of people said in the years afterwards, it was a legitimate military target in its own right. First of all, because it was this amazing transport hub, not only the railways, but roads too. Stalin and the Russians had requested that Dresden be on the list of potential bombing sites, because at that point in the war, February 13th, 1945, the Soviets were 60 miles away. You know, the Eastern Front was creeping closer and closer and closer. And any attack on Dresden would hamper troop movements and movements of vital equipment. On top of that, there were something like around 200 factories in and around the city, which were all engaged in war work, and highly technical war work too. This was optical instrumentation for various machinery. They were making bullets and cartridges. Every factory had been turned around to war purpose. Very darkly, on top of that, there were huge numbers of refugees. And this is one of the elements that makes the events of the night are extraordinarily nightmarish to read about anyway. But the further element of these incredibly vulnerable people having fled the Soviet advance from Silesia and Pomerania, these thousands of people piling into Dresden from the countryside, coming in through the railway station, being dispersed through the city to shelters, then to be sent, the idea was then to send them further westwards. But the Allied idea was that if you launched a big enough bombing attack on the city, it would cause such terror and confusion among so many refugees that that in itself would also hamper the German military and their movements. So the calculations were very cold and very frightening.
And at that point, on the Allied side, was there much squeamishness about the fact that a large number of civilians were likely to be killed?
All the memos that you read now in the fascinating collections of private papers to be found in Christchurch College, Oxford, Lord Portal, Lord Harris's papers, Arthur Harris, Air Chief Marshal Harris, who his name is most associated with the bombing of Dresden now. His papers are to be found in RAF Hendon. And what you see among them is Arthur Harris has borne the weight of moral responsibility. His name is a byword for basically butchery and for inflicting carnage and cold-blooded carnage. And it's, you know, it's no secret that he had a complete blank indifference to the fate of German civilians. He simply couldn't have cared less. But he was not alone. By that stage in the war, by 1944, by the start of 1945, when the Germans were still fighting back with extraordinary kind of ferocity, no, such delicate considerations had, I think, completely gone by the wayside. So it wasn't just Arthur Harris, and the decision to bomb Dresden kind of wasn't his. It came from higher up. And those higher up in the Joint Intelligence Committee and in the Air Ministry and in the War Office, no, I mean, I think the fate of civilians by then was a matter of chilling indifference. After Dresden, it suddenly became a different matter again there.
And was this British attitude of indifference, was that in any way influenced by the fact that Nazi Germany had treated civilians so appallingly throughout the war?
I think it was more to do with the duration and the scale of the war. I mean, it has been suggested and continues to be suggested that because of the German bombing campaign against Britain, for instance, it was Portsmouth, Belfast, Liverpool, as well as famously London and Coventry in November 1940. Coventry went up in a firestorm that melted guttering and made stones glow red and brought this hideous kind of death toll and just extraordinary kind of devastation. And then there were the Baedeker raids on Bath and Exeter and Canterbury. So there's always that sort of feeling and suggestion that there was an element of retribution in this, that Dresden, being this wonderful cultural jewel, was no longer sacrosanct because look at what the Nazis had done. There isn't really, though, anything to suggest that this wasn't retribution. This was more like taking a kind of sledgehammer to the enemy, as far as I can read from the papers and the correspondence that you see now. I can read it as just a desperate effort to make the war stop and to make the Nazis stop. It was beyond kind of retribution. It was just, there comes a point after so many years of conflict, after some 6 years of conflict, where just rationality, cold rationality, actually starts to evaporate. And there was something not wholly rational about the attack on Dresden, but the scale of the attack on Dresden. That said, you know, we never like to engage in counterfactuals, but it should have been different. The Americans were originally supposed to lead off with a daytime raid, and then the British would have followed afterwards with a nighttime raid. And in a counterfactual sense, perhaps that might have changed everything. If the Americans had the chance to launch that daylight raid, various technical reasons they weren't able to. But if they had, then perhaps after that, the city, the old city would have been evacuated. People would have made their way out to the suburbs. And then when the British raid came at night, maybe the results would have been less devastating. So fundamentally, these things can't be known. But what we do know is that directly after the Dresden raid, suddenly, instantly, the British and American attitudes towards area bombing and the bombing of civilians changed.
And that's a really interesting point, actually, because this was not the first heavy bombing raid on Germany, and indeed the death toll was higher in some of the other raids. So why does Dresden change things more than, say, the firebombing of Hamburg or something?
I think the other element in the Dresden story that inspires particular horror is that the raid came so close towards the end of the war. But again, this is hindsight. You know, we could say now February the 13th, 1945, where they were just weeks away from the end of the war. But yeah, we can say that confidently with hindsight. But it still didn't feel like that at the time. Obviously, the Nazis were dissolving, and that could be seen. But they were still fighting with such venom that it was conceivable that the war may have continued till the end of the year, bitterly sort of dragging on and on. So there is a case to be made that, you know, they couldn't have known, but the closeness to the end of the war makes it particularly horrifying. I think also, simply because it wasn't widely known how many factories there were, for instance, and it wasn't really widely understood about the railway junction and the troop movements, it looked like an indiscriminate attack on civilians, basically. And the way in which those civilians died naturally inspires the greatest horror, because it's almost impossible to imagine. It's so ghastly. All these thousands of people sitting in those dimly lit brick cellars, which, as I say, had been knocked through. They weren't specially constructed in any way to withstand what happened that night. As the fire started spreading after the first raid, basically the Dresden raid came in two waves, and that was the extra kind of cruelty of it. The air raid sirens started going at around 20 to 10. Dresden citizens started making their way down to these inadequate brick cellars. Then at 10:03 p.m., the first of the marker flares, the incendiaries, started coming down. Those who were watching from the suburbs and the hills around described these brilliant kind of white and green and red marker flares going down on targets, and describing them as Christmas trees. A number of children described them as Christmas trees because they looked so dazzling and mesmerizing and kind of weirdly beautiful. Then the incendiaries followed and the bombs followed. And those who were underneath those bombs in those brick cellars, because they'd been knocked through, the ventilation wasn't sorted out properly. And so the poison gases basically started seeping through from cellar to cellar. And on top of that, the fires raging above meant that the people in the cellars started to... Well, as I say, the suffocation began first. But then the first raid took about 25 minutes. Thousands and thousands of incendiaries and bombs falling on this very concentrated area in the old historic city. But then, in some parts of the city, the all-clear signal was given, and people started emerging from those brick cellars because they thought, that's it. You know, the raid's finished. They now had the fires to deal with. These great, gulping, devouring fires that were sort of eating away at all these timber-based buildings. And as they did that, there was some, like, the extraordinary account of Victor Klemperer that night, who, by that time, he and his wife were living in what was called Judenhauser, a Jew house. They'd been forced to leave their own home. And they were very close to the centre of the city. They'd been down in a shelter, witnessed the terror of the bombs falling, the extraordinary noise. And then after the raid, they emerged, saw the fires, and Victor Klemperer actually went back to bed. As indeed did a few other people around the city. There was a few teenagers went back to bed thinking about school the next day, even as those fires kind of took hold. And then, at around 1 a.m, the air raid sirens started again because there was another British formation coming over. And by this stage, the people returned now to those inadequate brick cellars, but by this stage the firestorm started to build and started to take a hold.
What was there in the way of defences from the German side? Were there any air defences? Were there any aeroplanes scrambled to fight the bombers?
There was pitifully little in the way of air defences. There should have been some anti-aircraft guns based around the city, and there had been previously, but they'd been moved to the Eastern Front as part of the effort against the Soviet forces. There were some German fighter planes at the nearby airport in the hills above the town, but 10 fighter planes against 796 of the British bombers. They knew, I think it was fairly clear that they knew there was very little that they could do. How do you take on this extraordinary this extraordinary kind of vision of the apocalypse, which is basically what the British bought. So in terms of defences, very, very little indeed. In fact, to all intents and purposes, nothing. That's one of the things that made the raid so, from the Allied point of view, so unusually, technically successful. The other element was the weather conditions, because curious enough, even though Sir Arthur Harris and many others were fascinated by the science and physics of firestorms, they were actually quite difficult to create because it depended so much on a certain set of weather. In Dresden that night, the weather conditions were perfect. And so all the fires within the old city were watched from above by the bomb aimers, who could see the streets below, that the kind of lattice of fires that they could see, these kind of the rectangles of fires as the flames spread from kind of street to street, and then basically started to turn the air inside out and became this kind of great onrushing fire tornado. So basically anyone who was out in those streets would find themselves being tugged, insistent if their lungs hadn't already been scorched and blackened, they could be tugged up into the maw of this kind of fire tornado, hurled up into the air and just burnt to death high up in the air. I mean, terrifying prospect.
And thinking about the bombers themselves, what kind of people were crewing these planes?
The people who were crewing these planes, I think, they were very often very intelligent and very sensitive young men. And this is the other difficult part of the story, actually. We've seen, for instance, how the statue of Sir Arthur Harris in London has been splashed with red paint because he's regarded as a war criminal. But how are you then to regard these extraordinary bomber crews? Are they to be seen as war criminals too? I mean, clearly, obviously not. What they did was the lives they led, almost impossible to imagine. Here were these young men who all volunteered. They weren't conscripted. Each Lancaster had a crew of seven people, from the pilot to the bomb aimer to the navigator to the flight tactician to the gunners who were basically defending. And they were flying deep, deep into enemy territory, particularly on this mission, knowing already of the extraordinary mortality rate so far in the war. 55,000, over 55,000 bomber crew had been shot out of the sky. So all these young men knew that the chances of them being shot out of the sky, falling, burning to the earth, were extremely high. Now, how do you live life like that? How does that work psychologically? In the Imperial War Museum now, and various other sources, there are lots of good diaries and letters who have been left behind by airmen, and they make extraordinarily moving reading now. Not just the courage, actually, but you just see this, I don't know, sort of determination to cling to life, to see it through, but knowing that what they did, what they were doing, was kind of vital to the war effort. To be part of the bomber crew, you had to be kind of incredibly kind of quick-witted and alert, ready to react to anything. But that sensitivity also meant that, you know, they were touchingly prone to superstition. There were lots of bomber crews who had to put their socks on in a certain way, or had to take cloth caps with them in their aeroplanes. Or there was one bomb crew member who always carried his girlfriend's bra with him on missions, because there was a powerful talisman. As long as he had that bra, somehow he would be safe. And you think, how was that possible to do that night after night? And then come back to base and see all those empty beds representing those who didn't come back, and live with that proximity to death. The cliched view of the RAF wartime airmen now is that of kind of ludicrous acronym-based banter. Some top hole, AO, all this BBFQ, all that kind of stuff. But actually, the reality was so, so much more serious. When they were back in England, they would spend their time sometimes going to lectures, academic lectures. They would read poetry. They would write poetry. As I say, these were cultured, sensitive men. And again, this is part of the moral fascination of the story, I think. I mean, their mission was very straightforward. Their mission was to destroy Nazism, because Nazism was a terrible moral taint that was threatening to take over the world. And they were doing everything they could. I think it was the literary critic David Lodge, whose own father was an airman, who said that there was this kind of image in later years of the airmen being almost like medieval knights, or knights on a sort of grail mission, that they had that kind of nobility about them. So whatever you think about the motives of Bomber Command itself and the ethics of area bombing and civilian bombing, it doesn't apply to these airmen themselves, who were just amazing in their courage, both physical and psychological.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And then it produced a reaction in Britain, particularly from Winston Churchill. He looked at Dresden and suddenly had an intense attack of anguish.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Back on the ground in Dresden, one of the subjects about the raid that's been quite fiercely debated over the years is the number of casualties. What do we know now about how many people were killed?
The Dresden authorities have themselves been extremely careful about this because in Dresden, even now, remembrance is a battlefield, and there are those who seek to appropriate the memory of the long-distant dead for their own political purposes. I mean, I'll come to that. But in the initial shock of the initial aftershock of the raids, it was Joseph Goebbels who put the number of fatalities as 250,000. There was never any evidence that it was as many as that, but it was vital for German propaganda purposes at that point that the Allies were to be seen as steeped in innocent blood as the Nazis were, that there was an equivalence here. Goebbels was very keen to get that out to the world, and it was one of those figures that was spread throughout the neutral countries. In later years, the figure was revised somewhat. There was a very controversial historian who put the number at 135,000 in the 1960s. That in itself had been gleaned from a historian in Dresden who I think possibly had his own agenda. And so once again, the figure of 135,000 became fixed, so much so that the novelist Kurt Vonnegut, who wrote the brilliant and now immortal Slaughterhouse-Five, which had Dresden and the Dresden bombing as its dark baseline, Kurt Vonnegut used the figure 135,000 too, because that was the accepted fact. Kurt Vonnegut, incidentally, had been an American prisoner of war, and he had been in Dresden that night. And ironically enough, many of his Nazi captors were much more vulnerable than he was throughout the bombing, because the slaughterhouse in question, where he and his fellow prisoners were being kept, literally a slaughterhouse where they were keeping the carcasses of pigs and sheep, but it was a concrete-based structure, so as the bombing unfolded, there he was. What's happened in more recent years is that there was a special historical commission in Germany based around Dresden to look into this question of numbers. And they have basically worked it out that the number of fatalities that night was around 25,000, which, again, is almost impossible to conceive of. I mean, this is one of those numbers where but you know, you can't. Also, I think, chillingly, it's impossible to be exact because there were so many refugees in the city that night. And presumably then so many undocumented people. And on top of that, one of the most hideous aspects of the story was when we're talking about body count, we're talking about what's left of bodies. In many of those brick cellars, what were very often found as desiccated mummies and some liquefied remains. There was the bodies without heads, the bodies that were dismembered, and in the streets themselves, in the hours and the days afterwards, there were civilians who came in from the suburbs in search of relatives, in search of friends, who basically had stepped out onto an alien, dead world, just complete rubble, where once had been streets, so they couldn't even navigate. And in among all this rubble were just body parts and heads. It's a vision of hell, and it's almost impossible to comprehend. And you also see this vision of the authorities, who were very quick to see that the threat of disease might come. So they had to get rid of these bodies very, very quickly. So they set up pyres in the Old Market Square, where hundreds of bodies were set fire to in the open air. And it was kind of like literally a medieval vision of the end of the world.
Did the raid on Dresden, as far as we know, have the military impact that it was intended to do?
Again, it's one of these questions that's very difficult to quantify. It certainly hampered troop movements, and it certainly knocked out factories like Zeiss Icon and Seidel & Naumann and various other factories around the town. I mean, in those terms, I would say yes. But the other side of that is that in terms of the damaged railways, for instance, there was a functioning railway line up and running just a matter of days afterwards. The Nazi authorities were very, very quick to get it moving again. And actually, one of the most extraordinary parts of the story, once you've been through the absolute nightmare of the firestorm, the bombing, and just the obscenity, the kind of medieval obscenity of all these corpses, is, you know, the medical authorities were quick, and the hospital stayed open. The senior medic, Dr. Albert Fromm, could have worked through the night of the bombing, made sure that hospitals were set up in villages around, so military hospitals were converted for civilian use. Civilians themselves were evacuated to rural billets. And in civic terms, the speed at which the authorities managed to get in kind of food and even simple things like some tea and coffee, I mean, just kind of extraordinary. So, I mean, in that sense, no. I mean, there was defiance in the city which could have said that no. And it kind of, you slightly wonder what the point of the lesson of it is, even with that level of devastation, does bombing ever work in any kind of conflict? And this is very much a question for now as well. You know, we see in conflicts in various places around the world, you know, the bombing of civilians. Can anyone think of a single example where it ever worked? In the case of Dresden, you have, I think, this fascinating distinction between the disgusting Nazi regime and the hapless Gauleiter, Martin Mutschmann. But then you've got a kind of civic response running alongside that. As I say, you've got these fantastically organized medical orderlies who piled in from kind of Berlin. You've got some fire engines piling in from some different towns around the region. There's people volunteering from around the region to help in the midst of this absolute devastation. There were witnesses who remembered medical orderlies going around checking people's eyes, because one of the most of all the many hideous things that night, those who were the walking wounded found their eyesight hideously damaged by the floating ashen embers that got everywhere. And we had these very sort of matter-of-fact orderlies going on spatulas and eye drops and organizing, shuffling groups of people in such a way that some comfort was kind of brought. So yes, the dark fascination of the story then is not just the devastation and the death, but how then people could respond to that. And it shows you something about the elasticity and the adaptability of the human spirit. It's absolutely extraordinary.
And earlier you mentioned the fact that attitudes towards bombing changed after Dresden. So what was the reaction in Britain and also in America to what happened?
Curiously, if you read the British newspapers now from the time, the day after the raid and the day after that, the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Mail and the Daily Mirror all published the news. They were all saying that Dresden is now a city in ashes. I think one newspaper put it at 1,400 bombers rather than 796 came over. There was no secret about the devastation that had been wrought. Even if they didn't say how many fatalities there'd been, it was absolutely plain that Dresden had been flattened. And there didn't seem to be an immediate kind of recall. In fact, rather tastelessly, the Daily Telegraph had a spoof joke headline in its Peterborough column, which said, Dresden, new version of Bull in China Shop, referring to the porcelain industry. Oh, really? It was an American reporter, Howard Cowan, who a couple of days after the raid was exploring further the devastation, and he described it in a report as terror bombing. He didn't do so critically, which is the curious thing. He did so with enthusiasm. He said, basically in this report, that at last the Allies have brought terror bombing to the conflict in an effort to extinguish the morale of the disgusting Nazi regime. But it was that crucial phrase, terror bombing. It somehow got past the censors, and it made its way into the American press. And at that point, the Americans recoiled furiously. From the point of view of the American Air Force and the American hierarchy, They had always been about what they called precision bombing. They engaged in daylight raids. They knew that it was absolutely vital that in moral terms, they always had to be completely way, way, way above anything that the Germans were doing. And this phrase precision bombing, there was no precision bombing. They didn't have the technology then for precision bombing. You know, if they were aiming for railway marching yards, civilians would get killed too. But that was certainly the intention anyway. And so this phrase terror bombing produced instant reaction. They just absolutely could not have this at all. And then it produced a reaction in Britain, particularly from Winston Churchill, who suddenly, he looked at Dresden and suddenly had an intense attack of anguish, so much so that he famously sent a memo to Bomber Command and to Arthur Harris, pleading that Britain should not engage in mere acts of terror. Now, to Bomber Command, particularly to Arthur Harris, that was an extraordinary kind of broadside because from Air Chief Marshal Harris's point of view, he'd been prosecuting a war. This is how to fight a war. He did not regard himself as engaging in mere acts of terror. But for the Prime Minister to suddenly turn and say that, it meant that area bombing was a strategy that they were now looking at very, very closely because it was also to do with what came after the conflict, from the British side, but also the American side. Because if it had been seen that they had been engaged in terror bombing, once the Nazis had been defeated, how best were they going to win the German civilian population around them if it had been seen that that had been their tactic? So part of this was about the propaganda that would come after the war and how Germany was to be denazified after the war. But also on top of that, I think there's a genuine kind of moral anguish from Churchill because he said, you know, have we become beasts? Basically, he was saying, is this kind of who we are? It's almost as if he had awoken from a fever dream. And you can almost see that happening in various other kind of figures around him too. There's a moment of blinking and then a sudden lurch of horror. It took a while for the phrase terror bombing to be used in the British press, but I think it was used in Parliament, brought up in Parliament by Richard Stokes, who had been very much against area bombing all the way through the war and was very particular about going for the government on that. And that, I think, was the point where people in Britain and America drew back from what had happened.
Was there a similar level of squeamishness felt about some of the attacks that were taking place, say, on Japan, where and Tokyo, the firebombing there killed far more people, in fact, than Dresden?
Yes, but the American raid on Tokyo on March the 10th, 1945, which again brought a firestorm that's far outweighed Dresden. And I think the answer to that is no, in a curious way. It's so difficult to know, isn't it? The exhaustion, not just among the senior command and the government after 6 years of conflict, but also, I suppose, among the civilian population too. And if the end of the conflict is within sight, how keen and sharp is everyone's moral sense at the end of that, if you simply want a conflict to come to a conclusion? I think the answer is no. And the raids on Germany still went on. There was a town called Pforzheim on the edge of the Black Forest, which previously had been known as the Golden City because that's where they made all sorts of watches and precision instruments. And again, had been completely turned over to war work and highly technical war work. But it was a beautiful city with lovely little streets and, again, inadequate shelters. And there was an Allied bombing raid on that after Dresden, which proportionally was far worse than Dresden. It killed something like 25% of the population of the town. It was about a quarter of the population of the town. Destroyed 83% of the housing. You know, the ultimate in what Lord Charwell, Winston Churchill's scientific advisor, would call de-housing, a very chillingly technocratic term for basically killing civilians. So it went on. And there were further raids on Dresden, too. February the 13th and the 14th didn't bring an end to it, because, of course, after the British raid on Dresden, the following day, on the 14th, the Americans came over for their daylight raid on the railway marshalling yards. Such was the horror of the night before that in a number of the civilian accounts that you read now, they almost hardly register the Americans. It's kind of a macabre truth. There was one 15-year-old lad who was obsessed with stamp collection, who was exploring with horror the ruins, looking for the relatives, and he became aware of the music in the sky as this new raid was coming over. And he remembered his disbelief, but then not being so touched by it. It was because the horror of the night before had been so intense. But following that, in the month afterwards, there was an American raid in March 1945, because once again, they were seeking to hamper troop movements. And then there was another one in April 1945. Now, that was literally 3 weeks before the end of the war. And that was quite a heavy American bombing raid, too. I think it was something like 600 bombers. And again, they were aiming very specifically for the railway marshalling yards because it was all about hampering movement of materiel and that kind of thing. And again, these raids didn't register in the way that the February 1945 one did. But I think they kind of show that the city was, in its own way, a legitimate military target.
So from what you're saying, I get the impression you disagree with the charge that has been levelled at the attack on Dresden, that this was some kind of war crime.
It was unquestionably an atrocity. It was unquestionably an abomination. In moral terms, it still absolutely chills the soul. The term war crime itself is, I think, difficult because it has a legal precision about it. And as I say, the Dresden was unquestionably an atrocity, but contrary to what many people say, there was a legitimate reason for bombing it. It wasn't simply going for defenseless citizens. It wasn't just that, even though, you know, you would say 796 bombers, obviously that is going to, you know, the aim obviously was to destroy a beautiful old city and to bring death to so many of its inhabitants. But if you were to describe Dresden as a war crime, you would then have to go back over the RAF's strategy of area bombing all the way through the war. And you would have to track it back, I think, and you would have to look at Cologne, and you would have to look at Hamburg, Essen, Lübeck, Mannheim, all the other cities that were targeted in the same way, and with civilian populations de-housed, as Lord Charwell would put it. And you'd have to ask then, were all those bombing raids war crimes as well? In which case, I think you would have to kind of rethink the entire kind of British strategy and kind of what the war was about. And that's obviously a legitimate thing to do, obviously, because you must always question every single aspect of this. But I think there's something about the phrase war crime that it's used in a moral rather than a legal sense. And it has an effect of actually shutting down avenues of inquiry in a curious way, rather than opening them up. Because it has an effect of shutting down inquiry into why precisely there were so many bombers used on a city, or, you know, why they came over afterwards. Were those war crimes too? Were the Americans equally guilty then of this war crime? It leads you all into all sorts of different directions. But, as I say, this is linguistics, really, because I wouldn't hesitate to say that it is unquestionably an absolutely horrifying atrocity for which it kind of goes beyond language, actually.
And then something which you do touch on later on in the book is how Dresden has recovered and come to terms with what happened to it over the years since. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about that.
I think, yes. I mean, the fascination of the story of the Dresden doesn't end in February 1945, because what you see then is the repercussive aftershocks of that night, but then also the aftershock of May 1945, when the Soviet forces march into Dresden and basically appropriate the city. Dresden, at that point, and, you know, so much of East Germany falls under the control of the Soviet Union and under the control of Stalin. And the speed with which the communists took over the civic structure, you could marvel at it. Every kind of aspect of life, every political aspect of life, from education, health, even Russian street signs going up in the summer of 1945. As I say, with the old city still this kind of alien dead world of rubble, absolutely kind of unrecognisable. But the suburbs around and the new town across the River Elbe, not so badly touched, in many cases not touched at all. So you still have this kind of functioning city kind of around the ring, which the Soviets then take over, and which then the population of Dresden, who've been living under Nazism since 1933, have been living under this totalitarian rule, now have to adjust to a new totalitarian regime. And yet somehow you read in different accounts, it's one of those extraordinary things among civilians, even amid the trauma, the unthinkable trauma, life somehow finds a way. Culture somehow finds a way. The famous Kreuzchor, there's a Dresden choir, which is famous throughout Europe and the world, from the Kreuzkirche, and they're the best singers. They never stopped, you know, all the way through. And they find new choristers in the immediate aftermath of the war as the Soviets take over. Opera comes back. It's an extraordinary city. And then the Soviets start rebuilding and clearing the rubble, which itself is the most extraordinary kind of Herculean task. And very often the case that civilians walking along the street would sometimes just be press ganged into moving rubble around because there weren't sufficient soldiers to do it. And they would find excuses if you didn't have the right papers on you. Right, that's it, you're doing a day's rubble clearing. On top of that, the Soviets were very quick to move into the factories and move into the agriculture and just basically steal equipment and steel machinery, which were all spirited back to the Soviet Union. So their totalitarian grip on the city was very quick. But in the 1950s, then, they start to bring housing projects and new architecture. And this is part of the Dresden that we see now, actually, curiously. Buildings from the 1950s and the 1960s, built in the wake of the death of Stalin, but still under the Soviet regime. Buildings which could gleam with kind of futurism, and you could see the kind of utopian thinking behind them, even if they look sort of grim and utilitarian. These housing projects still stand today, and they're actually in quite a good nick. And the main shopping plaza, the Praga Straße, which had once been fantastically sort of posh with kind of fur shops and jewel shops and all the rest, so it was reconfigured as this giant kind of rectilinear kind of architectural project. Next to that, then, you have the old city itself and the rebuilding thereof. And I think that one of the most extraordinary things now about the Dresden story is that if you were to visit the city now, and if no one had told you about the history, or if you knew nothing of the history of what had happened, you would look at a lot of these beautiful old buildings and you wouldn't have imagined for one moment that anything had happened. They rebuilt the castle by the river, the Catholic cathedral, most famously the Frauenkirche, this beautiful Baroque church with a wonderful dome, which had been built in 1726 and which had dominated beautifully the Dresden skyline, featuring in all these paintings from Bellotto and the various other people. This was one of the, obviously, the casualties of bombing. It just collapsed inwards a couple of days after the bombing. The dome just went sucked inwards by gravity. And the Soviets left it untouched for many years simply because, actually, there just wasn't the money to rebuild it. An incredibly difficult technical task. But in recent years, they have rebuilt it. And what you see now, not just the exterior of it, but the interior, which has been reproduced in every single particular way, from the amazing kind of blue and gold paintwork to the elaborate frescoes of saints that are painted on the ceiling, and the gold, the Garden of Gethsemane altarpiece, and the beautiful galleries, the 18th century galleries. Again, it's a marvel, actually. You walk into this thing and you think it could just be the real thing. It's absolutely extraordinary. But at the base of it, you see blackened masonry, and that was the original masonry of the Frauenkirche. And basically what they're saying is, yes, this is rebuilt, and this also shows you the rupture in history. But, yes, the regeneration of the old city and the very sensitive landscaping. So where they haven't reproduced buildings exactly, they've kept the skyline the same and they've kept the roofs the same. So that if you look out now from the top of the Frauenkirche, where you can go, there's a brilliant balcony where you can stand and overlook the city. And if you do so now, what you're looking out over is quite a faithful kind of reproduction of the city that you would have seen in the 1920s and the 1910s. And that is kind of inexpressibly moving because you can see in the descendants of those who live there now, there is a kind of comfort that comes with that. But the landscape is also carefully patterned with echoes of the past so that no one will ever forget. There are plaques all over the city to the Jewish population, for instance. There's obviously a great acknowledgement of the horror that was visited upon the Jews. There are rebuilds of things like the Kreuzkirche, where it's been in the interior has been rebuilt in a carefully sort of modernist style, and there are photographs of how it used to be and exhibitions of how it used to be, so that the past is always honoured and acknowledged. And it's very important because in Dresden, remembrance is so electrically sensitive and continues to be so today, because there are those on the far right, not only in Germany, but from all over the place, who want to appropriate Dresden and the bombing of Dresden for their own political purposes. They want the civilians of Dresden of the night of the bombing to be seen as martyrs to the Allies, because then it gives it an equivalence to the Holocaust. And you see, once you start going down that road, you see just how chilling it is, and you see how extraordinarily important it is that history is handled obviously with the greatest care by everyone. And as I say, the Dresden authorities are fantastically brilliant at this and have been fantastically brilliant on this. Every February the 13th now, the bombing is commemorated. There's a performance in the Kreuzkirche of the Dresden Requiem, which is composed by Rudolf Mausberger, this wonderful composer. And it's an almost overpoweringly moving work performed by the boys of the Kreuzkirche. Then at 9:45 or so in the Old City, all the church bells start ringing out. It's not a pleasant sound. They ring out with fury and chaos because it represents the air raid sirens. And there is a kind of terror in the noise, and you find yourself involuntarily looking up at the dark sky, and you can almost see the bombers. You can almost see the kind of marker flares. And these bells ring out furiously and with enormous clangor for about 20 minutes until 10:03, and that's the point at which the bombing started. And then Dresdeners light candles in the new Market Square and the old Market Square. And before that, the citizens of Dresden form a human chain as well, and that's basically to keep out the far right-wingers and various other lunatic protesters who want to grab this and grab history for their own. Because the Dresden are saying, no, this is how we mark this. And the important thing now, apart from anything else, is reconciliation and ensuring that no horror like this ever happens again. The Dresden authorities have also been working with, there's a British charity called the Dresden Trust, which has done fantastic work and works with the Dresden authorities and all sorts of different projects. There was the golden orb of the Frauenkirche, which I think was part of the work of the Dresden Trust. It was made in Britain and it was donated to Dresden as a mark of atonement, a symbol of atonement. I think very recently some trees have been planted in the new Market Square again as a token from the British side that this should never happen again. And Dresden has been twinned with Coventry. I mean, it has been for a number of years. They twinned in 1959. But there's always this sense of an intensely close relationship. In fact, actually, when I was at that recital of the Dresden Requiem that night in the Kreuzkirche, I was sitting next to an old German lady, and I don't quite know how. She divined that I was English. And at the end of the performance, she turned to me and said, "This is for Coventry too." So there's always that sense that we've got to bridge those gaps now and make sure that these atrocities cannot happen again. And that's basically the mission of the Dresden authorities. And it has to be pointed out, too, all of this, the modern city, as I've portrayed it, the commemoration is very serious and very somber, but Dresden is not a morbid place. It's exactly the opposite. It's incredibly light and blithe and full of life. And the streets are suffused with music again. It has the most amazing buskers in Europe. If you go there in the summer, which I recommend, it is absolutely wonderful. The streets of the old town and the city are filled with a cappella tenors doing extemporized opera. And there are people playing violins. There are people playing double basses. It's the cultural sense of the city. And, you know, this sense of it as a cultural centre is very, very much back again. And the streets themselves are very lively and friendly. You go across the river, there are some fantastic sort of bars and restaurants, but also the lively sort of student population. The streets are incredibly kind of friendly, and the city kind of pulsates with a cosmopolitanism, and it puts you very much in mind of the pre-First World War Dresden and the 1920s Dresden of artistic innovation and some hip young people doing kind of extraordinary, kind of vigorous things. I think that is the great triumph now of the Dresden story, and that's why I'd recommend anyone to go there. I mean, you just wouldn't want to leave.
I think I've been through everything I was going to ask you. Is there anything else you think we didn't cover that...
I didn't talk very much about the eyewitnesses looking at the firestorm. I mean, obviously, when you're in the eye of the storm, you can't see it because all you're seeing is death. There are people literally spontaneously bursting into flame in streets. Their clothes caught fire. The heat was so intense. Also, on top of that, there were glowing embers falling like kind of molten snow, if you can imagine. Such a thing. So even those who were not directly in the centre found that they emerged from the shelters. There's a lovely old couple called George and Marilyn Erler, and he was the air raid warden for his block a little to the east of the city. And they're quite a grand couple. They had a very, very nicely furnished flat, and they had the cellar underneath in which they sheltered. And their house hadn't been hit directly, but the windows had been blown out on the first raid. And they went into their apartment, and they were called glowworms, these embers that just flew in this ever-rushing wind. And everything started catching fire. Curtains started catching fire. Furniture started catching fire. and then became this desperate effort to preserve what they could, but then they realized that was going to be impossible. And then when the second wave came over, it was back to the shelters. Then their home was destroyed. So many others of countless homes were destroyed. But what you see from those eyewitness accounts, there's so many of them, from people who are living not directly in the center, not directly in the heart of that firestorm, but who are looking on from a slight distance from the hills around the town. They were kind of mesmerized by the terrible spectacle of it. There was a young physicist called Mishka Danos, who was working with Professor Heinrich Barkhausen at the university. And he was in the south of the city, overlooking the city as the firestorm took hold. And as a physicist, he was looking at this extraordinary phenomenon of physics, basically, this tower of light that rose almost a mile into the night sky and consumed kind of all within it. He said, to his own discomfort, he felt a little like the Emperor Nero watching Rome burning. But you could imagine from that distance not only the fear and the terror, but also just the not being able to move from looking at it. And you see a lot of that. There's one eyewitness, a young 15-year-old, who I think I've mentioned before, who was basically obsessed with the stamp collection, but he was there on that night helping refugees around. Helping refugees into shelters. Then when the raid began, he and his mate just about made it home. And again, they were on the other side of the river, so they weren't directly in the heart of the firestorm. But what he saw, the way that the sky started changing colour, the pullulating heat that came right the way across the river. And again, once again, the embers. So that he had to put on a pair of goggles in order to go outside, because otherwise he knew that his eyes would be singed and burned. And then seeing some figures emerging from the mist and the fog, the wounded soldiers leaving a hospital ward because part of the hospital had been hit. And as far as I can see, the 15-year-olds have almost seen these ghostly figures emerging out of the mist. These kind of unexplained things. Then you see, yes, as I say, there are people trying to make their way to the hospitals on the fringes of the old city, and the streets beneath them, the tar has completely melted, the tar has started to bubble, feet are getting stuck in the tar, people now can't move. It has the literal qualities of a nightmare. People having to get rid of their shoes, but then their feet burning so much that they fall to the ground, and then hands and elbows burning, and then they can't move anymore. And then, you know, these are the people who are then drawn up into this fire tornado. It has the qualities of worse than a nightmare, actually. Then, on top of that, you have the intense claustrophobic horror of the brick cellars themselves, and those within the cellars, say these women and the children, the elderly, who had no idea that the ventilation was so bad that basically the pure carbon monoxide and various other chemicals from the fire were beginning to whisper through that darkness. There were those who would have started to feel the tightness in their chest and the difficulty in breathing, and perhaps they might have put it down to fear, or they might have put it down to intense sort of anxiety. So many people suffered heart attacks, then just suffocated. As I say, it is kind of almost impossible to take in the scale in just a few hours. Then of the inferno then rising so high that people were just mummified and liquefied. It has to be said, the Dresden City Archives has done the most fantastic job in eliciting and soliciting eyewitness accounts from those who were there on the night. So they had a number of contributions from people who were children at the time, basically some teenagers and some children younger than that. They've also managed to get some diaries and letters, too, of people, of older people, older civilians, as I say, like George and Marilyn Erler, who were there that night. You get a sort of intense flavour of what the city was like before that as well, and kind of what came after. But through these eyewitness accounts, you start to get a sense of that kind of mosaic of horror. And that's everything from the understanding of the difficulty of moving, the horror of a street in front of you going up in flames, so you're having to backtrack and find another route out. That terror of going down to a cellar as the second bombing raid started. There was one particular eyewitness who said that there was a brewery that had a cellar, and that seemed to be slightly firmer than most cellars. But to get down to it, you had to go down some several flights of stairs. And then you just basically had this concrete cellar. And in the second wave, this witness remembered that suddenly the cellar started filling up with more and more people that hadn't been there before. And he realized that refugees were coming and people were just fleeing in off the streets. And then suddenly there was intense claustrophobic horror of suddenly there's no sitting room anymore, and suddenly standing room becomes difficult as more and more people are piling into this darkness. And then you suddenly realize on top of that the vulnerability of just the single light bulbs, and if the light bulbs should go, people trapped in that darkness. How do you even begin to fathom that? All I found myself doing reading those accounts is, I mean, the mind recoils, the mind flinches. You can't help putting yourself in that position. You can't help imagining what you yourself would have done in those circumstances. And I don't think I would have behaved with a fraction of the rationality of so many of the accounts that I've read, or indeed a fraction of the generosity and kindness that you see in so many of the accounts of people helping other people, people helping the elderly, people helping mothers with pushchairs get upstairs out of cellars. In a nightmare like that, you would imagine all the worst aspects of human nature come to fore. But in fact, actually, in so many of the accounts, you see very quietly so many of the best aspects of human nature, too. So amazing, you know, from the doctors who carry on working, even though part of the hospital has been hit, and even though the injuries that are coming in, I mean, the burns, just too hideous to imagine. But people carry on, and people helping each other to the hospitals. There were some cases where some elderly people just sat on steps and either wouldn't or couldn't move, either sort of transfixed with fear at the flames reaching to the sky above them, or giving up. But the younger people around them, teenagers, saying, no, we're not leaving you here. Come on, you're coming too. And, to be that together. And I'd say, in a story that's so intensely dark, you find yourself instinctively looking for the points of light. And there are these points of light, outbreaks of human kindness that you really would not expect to see in a cataclysm of that nature.
That was Sinclair Mackay. Dresden, The Fire in the Darkness was released a few days ago, published by Viking. And look out for a review of the book in the March issue of BBC History Magazine, which goes on sale on the 20th of February. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Friday when Michael Wood will be reflecting on the story of Peterloo.